Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are privileged to be blessed by the intelligence of a man who served, well, among other things, in the intelligence business for a long time, the clandestine services of the Central Intelligence Agency, to be specifically and exact, He is, of course, Sam Faddis, also known as Charles Faddis. He is a veteran of the United States Army and former Assistant Attorney General in Washington State. He is a former candidate for the Congress of the United States. He is a best-selling author, including of a very important nonfiction work called Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. It's good to have him with us always. Sam, thanks for joining us. Welcome back.
Great to be here as always, Frank. Thank you.
Sam, among your many achievements has been some important involvement, both as a candidate and more recently as someone working tirelessly to try to reestablish election integrity. You're based now up in Pennsylvania, and it's a state that was a swing state in the last election. It had been clearly, I think, afflicted with fraud and other irregularities, some of which had been enabled, sadly, by the Republican-controlled legislature there. Tell us what's going on the ground in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania at the moment, what you're trying to do to get those Republicans to shape up and get election integrity in Pennsylvania restored.
So this has become a contest really between the base, my terminology, and the establishment in Harrisburg. We moved to this mass market mail-in voting. We saw the results. The base is certainly convinced there was mass fraud. And once this bill repealed, let's go back to in-person voting. There is no movement in Harrisburg to do that, despite the obvious issues here. In fact, it's so bad that the Pennsylvania State Party actually commissioned, they set up a committee with folks out of the party apparatus to study the problem of what happened in the election and make recommendations. The committee, the official committee, reached the conclusion that there were in excess of 200,000 votes in Pennsylvania that had been counted but could not, in fact, be connected to a registered voter. So either there's a problem with the databases or we just experienced massive fraud. But the real point being, nobody's ever bothered to resolve it. And as of right now, we still don't know who actually won the election in Pennsylvania. These are the official findings of the state committee.
And those 200,000 votes would be more than enough to swing the election if they weren't all, in fact, for Joe Biden, I take it.
Greatly in excess of the margin of victory. So if this is in fact fraud, quite likely Donald Trump, in fact, won the state of Pennsylvania. Again, these are the results of an official state committee, party committee, Republican committee, and then there were a series of recommendations that went with it, again, official, beginning with Repeal Act 77. The Pennsylvania legislature has decided to completely ignore this report. In fact, after reviewing the report, they then said they didn't even want the people on the committee to come testify in the ongoing hearings in Harrisburg. They've simply buried the official Republican review of this and pretended like they'd never heard it.
These are, again, Republicans in the state legislature who control it. Is that correct?
This is a Republican-controlled legislature talking to a committee appointed by the Pennsylvania Republican Party, all consisting of folks in the party apparatus. So this is not a group of conspiracy theorists. These are the folks chosen by the state party to investigate the situation and reached a conclusion and said, yeah, there's a very good chance here that we just saw massive electoral fraud and at least 200,000 votes came out of the ether, put this in black and white, submitted it as an official report.
And specifically recommended that the act that enabled this, namely this mail-in balloting act, no excuse mail-in balloting, I guess is the term for it, had to be repealed. And there's no evident interest in repealing it? Is that also what we should take away from this?
So literally, if you look at the report, and there's a series of recommendations, recommendation number one, bold heading, repeal Act 77, could not be any clearer. Not only is the report being ignored, but none of the committee members, including the chairman, even after they made direct requests to testify, are going to be allowed to testify before the legislature. The entire thing buried and moving on.
Now, Sam Faddis, you have been promoting, I know, a petition aimed at trying to get the powers that be in Harrisburg, the Republican-controlled state legislature specifically, to change direction here, and not just with respect to mail-in balloting. You've got a whole number, I think 12 different recommendations in this petition. How do people find that petition and sign in? Is it only open to people from Pennsylvania, or is it open to others as well?
If you go, it's really for Pennsylvania voters. There are a couple of groups online, Free PA and Pennsylvania Committee for Election Integrity. You'll find both of them on Facebook and access that. But this is a broad-based now issue that is turning rapidly into what's going to be primary challenges to a very large proportion of the Pennsylvania state legislature. There's going to be a lot of folks who are going to lose their jobs over this.
Yeah, well, and rightly so, it seems to me. Quickly, can you tell us about what's going on in Georgia and Arizona at the moment? There are similar kinds of problems that have been identified by people there, either officials or state legislatures or outside experts. Are either of those states likely to serve as models for what should be done, not only in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, but in other states where these kinds of problems were manifest in 2020?
Yeah, well, I mean, in particular, I would say Arizona, where they're actually doing a physical audit of all the ballots. And this is, I mean, you would think that anybody who's on the side of election integrity would want this. But let's just review this and establish concretely and conclusively what just happened. And if it shows that Joe Biden won the election, you would think he'd be the happiest guy in the world. You know, he can do a little victory dance in the end zone and announce that, stop whining and I'm the legitimate president. But of course you see. Yeah, but of course you see the opposite, don't you?
We're, as we speak, told that there is a new judge overseeing that audit. And by the time this show airs, he may have made a ruling that will interfere with it. I hope not. This clearly is a needed corrective to what seemed to be some pretty serious problems in the state of Arizona. We're going to hold you over for another segment, Sam Faddis, and I appreciate so much your joining us. We can talk perhaps not so much about Georgia, but I would like to talk about H.R. 1 or S.1 in the Senate that has some very serious problems associated with it as well from an election integrity point of view. And we'll do that on the other side of a short break. Stay tuned.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. And we are welcoming once again Sam Faddis, one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. He is a former clandestine services officer in the Central Intelligence Agency and these days is working tirelessly at andmagazine.com. to raise awareness about a whole host of challenges we're facing in this country, but not least that to our elections integrity. And Sam, you were walking us through some of the challenges that were manifest in the 2020 election. Suffice it to say, there are significant problems in Georgia, and we're hoping that the state legislature's efforts to fix them will prevail and be sufficient. to boot. But let me turn to an effort that would countermand such efforts, both in Georgia and Arizona and your state and across the country, namely something called S1 in the United States Senate. It's under consideration as we speak. It is, I think our audience knows, deeply problematic. Tell us why, as you see it, and why it's vital that it be rejected.
Right. Well, I mean, at least a couple of massive issues with this bill, right? I mean, first of all, it represents essentially a complete federal takeover of the elections nationwide, which I think is pretty clearly in complete contradiction of the United States Constitution that says straight up that it's the state legislatures that control this. So that's a pretty big problem. I mean, what it's designed to do is take everything that was just foisted on us piecemeal, state by state, in November of last year and implement it in perpetuity across the entire country. It's going to all of the problems that we were just talking about and that happened in Pennsylvania and other states with massive electoral fraud will just be built into the system henceforward. And at best, you will never know again who won any election. And I think we all can presume based on who's pushing it and who's getting behind it, that it's clearly designed to make sure that the Democratic Party essentially turns this entire nation into a one-party state. I mean, the bottom line is there's no way to police mass market, no excuse mail-in voting the way they have designed it. It's impossible. It's a dream for a person who wants to steal an election.
Right. And it's just one of the ways that elections can be stolen. And it seems that all of them are basically not just permitted under this bill, but mandated as well. And the challenge to anyone who wishes to assure election integrity will be surpassingly hard, it seems. So again, we are anxious to see people in this audience, among others, reaching out to those who represent them in the United States Senate and making clear that what's come to be called the Corrupt Politicians Act, but better known as S1 in the United States Senate, not be approved by those representatives. It's really of just tremendous importance. Please weigh in, folks. And let me give you the phone number that you can call that will get you to your state senator, and that is 202-224-3121. I hope you'll do it today. Next up, I want to talk with you, Sam, about another part of the portfolio that you've been covering handsomely at AND Magazine specifically, and that is the effort to fundamentally transform our country, not through the ballot box or the stuffing of the ballot box, more accurately, but through revolution in the streets. And an organization that has been very central to all of that is the Black Lives Matter organization. Talk a little bit about your conclusion that what we're dealing with in this entity is a Marxist revolutionary enterprise. How did you arrive at that conclusion? What are its goals? And what must we do in response?
Well, I think all you have to do with Black Lives Matter is sort of pay attention to what they say, read their own literature, listen to their own leaders speak, and they will tell you pretty clearly what they are about. They are an expressly Marxist organization. They are not about marginal reform. They're not about a kinder, gentler police force. They're about a complete Marxist revolution. And they use terms like revolution all of the time, and it is discussed openly. And here's the other thing that I think people need to understand. This revolution is already underway. And as far as Black Lives Matter and their allies are concerned, so far it's going very well. And so they did not come out of the Derek Chauvin trial, for instance, in Minneapolis with the, well, that business is concluded, that's all fixed response. They are just simply encouraged to become more aggressive in their measures. So all of this is going to intensify. And there, you know, you can see this even at the ground level. For instance, in Minneapolis, there's an area around where the intersection where George Floyd died, which has been named the George Floyd Square Autonomous Zone. And it's been outside the control of the city since last year, going on a year now. It literally functions with checkpoints, and the police don't get in, and emergency services don't get in. And, you know, people hear, it's a complete no-go zone, and people hear that and they think, okay, that's a little silly, and they can't really be serious about this. And, you know, that's the problem, that people dismiss this. They don't understand. No, they are absolutely serious about it. This is a reality, and these kind of autonomous zones are not going away. They're going to expand, and this is not a supposition. They are expressly discussing how there need to be more of these, and they need to be bigger and more, take on more function.
Right. And the object is to advance this larger agenda, obviously, of challenging authority, subverting it, and ultimately replacing it with something of their own making. No,
this is literally bedrock, old school Marxist doctrine and tactics. This is functionally, from a ideological standpoint, exactly what the Viet Cong would be doing in the Mekong Delta in 1965, liberating a village and then declaring it autonomous and no longer under the control of the government. And then pretty soon you have hundreds of such villages, and pretty soon a big chunk of a state. And that's precisely where we are with this. And that makes
it must be resisted, needless to say. The law of the land must be enforced, and that is unfortunately going to be an ugly situation. I think there's no getting around it, but it's better done sooner than later. By the law enforcement authorities of our country, that's what they're there to do, and if need be, the National Guard as well. It will get worse otherwise, there's no doubt about it. Sam, I appreciate your attention to all of this, as well as calling ours to it as well. Let me talk to you next about another topic that I know is on your mind and should be on all of ours, Sam, and that is the coronavirus, or I think more accurately described as the CCP virus, the Chinese Communist Party virus. It turns out has a sponsor that is surprising, if not absolutely shocking, when we learn who it is and with whose resources that sponsorship was undertaken. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, the guy in question is Dr. Anthony Fauci, who keeps telling us that he's the patron saint of saving us from this virus, but seems to be up to his eyeballs and connections to it. Fauci was involved with what's called gain-of-function research, has been involved for many years, which basically is figuring out a way to make a virus more deadly. Has some legitimate applications, but obviously very, very dangerous, because if you make something more deadly and it gets loose, you got a big problem.
And just a word about the legitimate purposes. It's to have something that you can demonstrate you have a cure for. Is that the idea?
Well, viruses mutate, and one of the ways they can mutate is become more deadly. If you can predict and establish in advance how a virus could mutate, you could potentially develop a medication or a vaccine for it before that mutation appears in nature. So from a theoretical scientific standpoint, you could see why there might be a legitimate purpose to this. But on the other hand, if you're making things more deadly and they get loose out of the lab, you've created Frankenstein's monster. So,
or if you're making them more deadly because you wish to weaponize them, that's another reason this is a concern.
The other danger is it could absolutely be used deliberately as a biological weapon. Based on all of this stuff back in 2015, the U.S. government shut down gain-of-function research in the United States, to which Fauci's NIH responded by funding the research to be done abroad, you guessed it, in Wuhan, China, in the lab from which it seems increasingly likely that this virus originated. And by the way—
And a lab that has been— Finish that thought.
Well, in a lab that has been documented by the U.S. government as being deficient in its safety practices and so forth. So we have
found. And we think associated with the biological weapons program China's not allowed to have, and yet does.
And absolutely does. It's one of the, you know, they say they don't. That's nonsense. Of course they do. So Fauci funds this money. By the way, not only does Fauci send this money there, but it appears pretty clear that Fauci funnels this money in a way deliberately designed to circumvent the order that this research be shut down. In other words, he was not only just sending money to China, but sending money to China that he knew well should not be going there, and this research should not be continuing. Then we now...
He was doing this kind of research inside the United States. The Obama administration told him to stop doing it. And you're saying that he not only found a workaround, a way to continue doing it, but he did it somewhat surreptitiously because he knew that it was not permissible. Is that right?
That is exactly what I'm saying. He funneled the money through an NGO, a private entity, to Wuhan, and exactly, and didn't inform CDC of this. So he kept this, if you will, underground, continues to send this money.
On the Trump administration's watch, let the record show, and it sounds from Dr. Peter Navarro's testimony that they were unaware that he was doing this. Sam, we are hard out of time, but this is a topic to which we will return as soon as possible because it is obviously of extraordinary importance and deeply outrageous if all of it is actually true. We'll explore that with you if you will join us again very soon. And I thank you for your time today, as always. And Godspeed in your important continuing service to our country, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Baggio Leung, a former member of the Hong Kong Legislative Council, about what's happened to his beloved city and what it means for us. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's a great pleasure to say we're joined for, I believe, our second visit with Baggio Leung. He is a Hong Kong activist and advocate, a man who was for a time a politician and member of the Legislative Council of Hong Kong. And I want him to tell you a little bit about his personal story in that regard, because it's both, I think, evidence of his courage as well as his commitment to freedom in that once free territory. Baggio, it's good to have you back. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us today.
Thanks for interviewing me as well. My honor to be here.
We know a little bit about what's happening in Hong Kong, but you were kind of an early casualty of what the Chinese Communist Party had in mind for that territory. Talk about your personal experiences and then back the lens up a little bit and talk about what is happening to Hong Kong today, if you would.
So let me briefly introduce my experience first. I'm Baggio, a former legislator who was elected back in 2016 and one of the first few who was forcefully disqualified by the Chinese Communist Party from our local parliament. And CCP recent repression in Hong Kong is making Hong Kong in a really bad situation right now. They are silencing almost all well-known activists, and the truth is even more depressing on the ground. Just 20 hours before, the regime also passed a law that should grant the regime to ban anyone in Hong Kong from leaving. So it means that anyone when you like are now in Hong Kong and you do something that CCP don't want you to do, they can ban you from leaving Hong Kong lawfully. And that you can see how dangerous Hong Kong situation is right now.
Yeah. The piece of this personal story that I wanted you to share is you use the occasion of your swearing in to the Legislative Council to make a very pointed and, I think, again, quite courageous denunciation of what was afoot with the Chinese Communist Party. It has, as you say, ramped up enormously since then, notably with the enactment of this national security law, and now a statute that basically has Beijing exclusively picking who will represent people in the Legislative Council. And as you say, now, you know, a prohibition on leaving the territory. This is the inexorable, slow, I don't know, garrotting, I guess you might say, of the people of Hong Kong. But talk a little bit about how some of your former colleagues leading the opposition to all of this, and I'm thinking of Jimmy Lai and Martin Lee in particular, two prominent figures, are suffering for having opposed the Chinese Communist Party's agenda in Hong Kong.
After CCP launched the national security law in Hong Kong, actually more than 100 of Hong Kongers And a lot of those immigrants activists like Jimmy Lai, like Martin Lee, and some youngsters like Joshua Wong and Xiao, most of those activists are either now in jail or in exile. And when they charge you with national security law charges, they can ban you from leaving Hong Kong without any legal procedure started. And the worst case is that most of those arrestees now they do not have the right to go bail out because they can pick judges to be in charge for those cases. And you can think like nothing good follows because the judges is from their side. They pick it and there's no jury. And so definitely the result will not be a good one.
Yeah, inevitably you're guilty of whatever you're charged with. So this raises the question for you, Baggio, as to what can the United States do in response to what is happening in Hong Kong? This was an important outpost of the free world. And again, courage, not only that you've exhibited, but that many people in Hong Kong did in standing up to Beijing until COVID-19 or the CCP virus, as we call it, was unleashed there, among other places. And then this national security law was instituted. So what sorts of things, you're now in exile yourself here in the United States, what are you telling our elected officials and other leaders, or what would you like them to know, I guess I should say, about not just the state of affairs in Hong Kong at the moment, the true extermination of freedom in that area, but what the United States could helpfully do about it?
First of all, I must reiterate that China expansionist and coercive objectives are not only a problem for Hong Kong, even not just for Asia, but a looming threat to international order and democracy everywhere. From the denial of responsibility for the pandemic, to Uyghur genocide, to supporting Myanmar military massacre, they all show that United States leadership in confronting the China problem has never been more important. We urge for meaningful sanctions. We need actions and pressure to yield the result, at least to push back China repression to the region that are suffering, like in Hong Kong, like in Tibet, to Uyghurs, or even Thai and Thailand and Myanmar. So the United States should lead, stand up and pray tough against China by all means necessary, including like to boycott the Beijing Olympics, including to shut down a China ATM by using Hong Kong financial center status.
Let's drill down on those two recommendations because I feel very strongly about both of them. The Chinese Communist Party will, all other things being equal, in February of next year be honored by the international community, as it's called, with holding Olympic Games. We know from, well, back in 1936, the benefit to an authoritarian regime, or worse, a totalitarian one, of having such an honor paid to them, having such legitimacy granted to them. When Hitler exploited the Games in Berlin of that year to enormous effect, and I think was emboldened by what he got out of it to do some of the things that made his reign so horrific for his own people and the world. And a similar outcome seems inevitable if the games go forward in China. So you're saying that one of the things that would be appropriate for a whole bunch of reasons, including the one of Hong Kong's mistreatment, would be for us to insist on moving the games elsewhere. We've called for, at the Committee on the Present Danger, China freedom games outside of China, not genocide games inside. Have I got that right? That's something you would very strongly support as well?
Absolutely. Because like modern war is not about tanks and machine guns, but the ability to pressure opponents extend beyond the like conventional battlefield and increasingly includes the unconventional forms of warfare. And what I try to mention is that China is actually achieving the expansionist objective by doing any kind of actions that they can. They are supporting those other dictatorships in especially in the APEC region. They are expanding their influence, like in Middle East as well, like to Iran. And eventually this will harm like the global orders. And I think the 2021, I think the 2022 Beijing Olympics is the best chance like for the free world to stand up and to say no to China's repression and aggressive behavior on this.
Amen. Let me ask you about the other thing you mentioned. The Hong Kong dollar, as a kind of unique currency for Hong Kong, has long been tied by the United States government to the value of the U.S. dollar. And in this fashion, China has been able, since it took over Hong Kong, to essentially extract hard currency from the United States through transactions in Hong Kong. You called this an ATM, an automatic teller machine for Beijing, and that we should stop allowing that to happen. Talk a little bit more about that and why it would be really very, very harmful to China were the United States to take that punitive action.
Yes, like, for example, like United States actually imposed some financial sanctioning to China, especially to like to delete some like state-owned or some close relations company with the Beijing government in U.S. But what they are what China trying to do to minimize their losses is that they try to lease all those companies in Hong Kong, and Hong Kong, because of the tie of Hong Kong dollars and U.S. dollars, so they can like still capture cash flow from the free world, from the Wall Street, from those I banks through Hong Kong, and if they try to go lease all these like state-owned or companies that are very close to the Beijing government in Hong Kong, actually Hong Kong government won't stop it, and they are using this spot to get cash flow to boost their own economy. And the strong response actually to China's repression among the region is that, okay, if you continue doing this, we will shut down your ATM. And if this hurt like the economy, this will put a huge pressure to China, and for maybe to have a better chance to bring China back at least to the negotiation table.
We need to discuss this further with you, Baggio. This is something that I think is of surpassing importance, and anything we can do to help disincentivize the further oppression of the people of Hong Kong, I think, is in order. And you've given us two good ideas, and we will continue to talk them up here at Secure Freedom Radio. Come back to us again soon, if you would. In the meantime, thank you for standing up for freedom in your own city and elsewhere around the world. Next up, we'll speak a little bit more about what China is up to here as well as elsewhere with another of our duty experts on the subject, Lance Crayon, former, employee of the Chinese propaganda arms in Beijing. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to Lance Crayon. He's one of the folks that we have come across who has some very interesting insights into what the Chinese Communist Party is doing in the way of influence operations, both inside our country and against the free world more generally. He has a unique vantage on that topic because for a time, both in Beijing and in Los Angeles, he worked for arms of the Chinese propaganda operation. He is a very thoughtful guest, and we're always delighted to catch up with him. Lance, thanks for joining us. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me. Good to hear from you.
I want to start with the 1,000 Talent Program as an, it seems, extraordinarily successful Chinese technology acquisition or theft operation, as well as presumably an influence operation to boot. We understand that there are some 500 scientists across America who are now under investigation by the National Institute of Health for having undisclosed ties to, participation in, remuneration from the Chinese Communist Party. What's up with all of that, and what's the significance of it as you see it?
Well, with the Thousand Talents Program, which has been around since 2008, it's really it's a talent exchange or and recruiting exchange program on the surface, but really underneath that, it's they're taking the Chinese scientists and researchers and doctoral students, they're taking what they're learning here in the States and beyond that back to China, and American professors and other scientists are helping them do it. That's why you have 500 people under investigation. That these 500 people that are under investigation, they're not all Chinese nationals. A lot of them are not just Chinese Americans, but Caucasians and people of various ethnicities, all American citizens, who maybe wittingly or unknowingly did.
Including the former chairman of the Harvard Chemistry Department. And do we have a sense, Lance, of the kind of information that has been provided in this conduit to China? What kind of technology capabilities they may have garnered and what the implications of the loss of that technology might be for us?
They threw out a really big net, I mean, in terms of the science. I mean, they focus on agriculture, which there's been several cases of seed technology stolen. GMOs, that type of research, artificial intelligence was a big target, and also other, basically like AI, anything AI for the most part, that's what they were looking for, and that's what they wanted to learn, and that's what they took back, and it's still happening.
When you see this in isolation, it is a problem. When you see it as part of a larger enterprise, industrial scale effort the Chinese are making to subvert us domestically, it's even worse. And talk about another facet of this, Lance, which is that subversion operation, that influence operation, that is. The so-called Confucius Institutes, they're best known for what they're doing on college campuses across this country, but that's not the full extent of this endeavor, is it?
No, it's not. That's where it began. They're actually, it's much more expansive among the K-12 schools in America. They have over 500 Confucius Institutes at the K-12 level. So there's maybe, 100 at the university level, a little bit less now, some have closed. But the K-12 are still moving forward. You hear about the college campuses maybe closing and so on and so forth, but you don't hear about the K-12 programs being ended because they're not. They're actually expanding. There's 500 and counting as we speak.
500 and counting operations aimed at our kids. What do they purvey in these kinds of programs, particularly in the K-12?
And what they purvey in terms of a threat is the communist ideology. The goal, is to instill in younger generations that there's nothing higher than the Communist Party of China. The ultimate goal, of course, is to wipe out religion. But the people who are inside teaching the K-12 programs are quite scary. In fact, one guy committed suicide in October amid a child porn investigation. This happened in October in Missouri. You go to the school's Facebook page, and there's nothing but pictures of children. It's scary. And this received scant attention in U.S. media.
Well, I'm afraid none of this is getting the attention that it deserves, and it's so troubling because whether it's Hollywood or whether it's their entrance into the media in various other ways, notably these advertising supplements that we've talked with you about before, or this kind of activity on our campuses or in our, lower educational systems as well, it's a comprehensive effort to take us down. And it's chilling that we are not only not paying attention to it, we're doing nothing to speak of, it seems, with the possible exception of some of these Confucius Institutes that have been closed at the college level, and the roll-up of at least some of these professors or researchers or scientists in the Thousand Talent programs. Certainly not nearly enough to counteract all of these influence operations. But speaking of Hollywood, it was interesting to me that this lady named Chloe Zhao received an Academy Award from the Screen Actors Guild in Hollywood this week in Nomadland. It didn't seem to get the kind of play from the Chinese propaganda arms that you formerly worked with that I would have expected for a Chinese expatriate. They generally are very big on taking credit for whatever anybody of Chinese extraction does, whether it has anything remotely to do with the Chinese Communist Party and its activities or not. What's the backstory there, if you know it, Lance?
This is a very interesting story happening and still unfolding. After she won the Golden Globe for Best Director for Nomadland, an interview that she gave for an Australian film magazine surfaced, an interview that she gave 8 years ago, where she made some remarks, about, you know, disparaging remarks about China. Not really hardcore, but nothing too offensive and nothing we haven't heard other directors say. But they've taken this interview. Somehow it just, you know, it surfaced. Okay, it had been buried, and they said there was a supposedly national uproar over this interview, which there wasn't. And they said we're going to cancel Nomadland. Nomadland was supposed to play in Chinese theaters in April, so they canceled that. And then the Academy Awards was a month later, which actually happened on Sunday. She wins Best Director, first Asian to win Best Director, first Chinese expatriate to win in the history of the Academy Awards.
Woman of color is how it's been described in Hollywood.
Yes. And it was the only second woman, period, to win Best Director. And they still cancel Nomadland. And they buried it. They've taken it off all Chinese websites, which they did, a month ago. The real concern, the reason why they've done this, is not because of her comments that she made in a magazine, an obscure interview 8 years ago. China is looking for a reason to block her upcoming film in November called The Eternals. It's a Marvel, it's part of the Marvel franchise. And this film, The Eternals, is going to feature the first openly gay superhero. So China wants to block that. And if they can ride, they're going to ride on the coattails of this interview and say, well, she made anti-China remarks, so she's blocked from the mainland. That's what they would rather say that than say, well, we're not going to play this film in our theaters in November because it features a gay character. And gay characters and gay themes were officially banned from Chinese studios beginning in 2015.
I had no idea that was the case. And this is all the more stunning because, Lance, as you know very well, China is a bigger and bigger factor in what is produced in Hollywood. Because if it's not going to play in those Chinese theaters, as you've indicated, that's a big bite out of the possible return on investment for the Hollywood producers and their backers. So this would seem to put them very much athwart the direction that Hollywood is otherwise moving inexorably in, namely promoting the gay lifestyle and agenda. No.
Yes, it will, and they don't want a global backlash because to happen if they block the film because of its gay themes or gay characters. That China doesn't want to deal with that. That would be a PR nightmare to begin with.
But they're not backing away from the policy. They're just trying to finesse how much they're exposed to criticism over it. Fascinating stuff, Lance. And this is one of the reasons why we value so much your insights into the thinking inside the Chinese Communist Party and its propaganda instruments. We appreciate your sharing them with us from time to time. Come back to us again very soon if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.